Hey everyone, welcome to episode 354 of F-Stop, Collaborate, and Listen with your host, Matt Payne. This week on the podcast, I'm sharing an absolutely hilarious yet informative chat I had with one of my favorite photographers and fellow podcast hosts, Richard Burnaby. Richard is the host of a great podcast, Beyond the Lens, and he's been in the nature photography business for 20 years. Richard and I were co-leading a workshop to Antarctica and decided to record in person while crossing the tumultuous Drake Passage back to Argentina, a task we found as fun as it was athletically demanding on a rolling and rocking boat. In this chat, Richard and I talk about a lot of engaging subjects, so I think you'll have a really good time listening. By the way, I'm always looking for thought-provoking guests or panelists for the show. If you have an idea, please reach out. Okay, let's get to this week's episode with Richard Burnaby. All right, we are here in the Drake Passage with Richard Burnaby.
And Matt Payne.
And Matt Payne, that's me.
Of F-Stop, Collaborate, and Listen.
And Richard Burnaby of Beyond the Lens.
This is going to be fun.
It is going to be fun. We are just concluding a 21-day trip to the Falkland Islands. We were supposed to go to South Georgia, but we decided not to because of bird flu. And then we spent a ton of time down in the Weddell Sea and in Antarctica looking for emperor penguins and tabular icebergs and amazing scenes. And I think we came home with some really great stuff.
I think it was a success, you know, considering we had to change our itinerary and this awful pestilence, or whatever you want to call it, some kind of bird flu that apparently is not affecting the birds, but it's affecting some of the mammals like the seals, and the authorities just don't want people coming and spreading it around. So it's a good idea, and I think we made the right choice, and we went to some wild places in the Weddell Sea. So
yeah, I mean, we knew going into this that this itinerary could change really quickly, but I think we made the right decision. And, you know, how many people do you know that have had the opportunity to photograph emperor penguins jumping off of icebergs into the ocean?
It's a career highlight for me. It really is. It sounds like we're kind of exaggerating as we go along. You know, we're talking to our clients, you know, this is the most awesome thing, but seriously, I've never seen an emperor penguin prior to today. I mean, prior to this trip.
And you've been down here 8 times?
I think it's actually my 7th.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, trips to go see the emperor penguins, you have to fly into, I think, King George Island, and then you take a helicopter to Snow Hill Island, and you camp out on the ice for 3 nights to photograph them, and it costs upward of $60,000, $70,000, $80,000. And we saw at least a couple dozen.
Yeah.
That was great.
And we got to walk on the ice shelf with an emperor penguin at sunset in amazing light. I mean, come on.
Highlight. That was highlight. Plus, we had the little chin strap over on the left.
Oh.
With the blowing snow and the backlit.
Spindrift snow. In. Oh, my gosh. Awesome.
And now we're on the Drake. Wasn't a highlight. Last night wasn't a highlight. I can tell you, you don't know what happened, do you?
I don't. Yeah, why don't you? So just real quick for our audiences, you know, we have all these topics written down, but this is going to be a pretty free-form podcast episode for both of us. But I think it would be an amazing way to start the podcast by you explaining how you spent your evening.
There were some rumors flying around the boat that I was in some kind of trouble, but I got sick for the first time in, I don't know, 10 years, 8 years. And I knew it was coming on. I was sitting in my bunk. I could feel it coming on. My head started sweating, just getting hot. And then there's this, like a metallic, acidic taste in my mouth. I knew it was going to come. So I'm sitting in my bunk. And as you know, we're on the deck that doesn't have a bathrooms in our cabins. So in order to get to the bathroom, we've got to go down the hall. I have to go down the hall pretty good ways, take a left, and hopefully, first of all, if I'm going to get sick, I can make it. And if I am able to make it, that there's not somebody already in there, it's not occupied. So I'm doing all these calculations in my head, and I have a sink right in front of my bunk. It's a sink, and it's right in front of the door. So if you open my door, it's the first thing you see when you walk in my cabin. So it was obvious that I wasn't going to make it outside. I didn't want to take that chance, so I go for the sink. And I'm not going to use the V word, but I get sick right in the sink. And the first thing I notice is that it's been so long since I've been sick, is that when you get sick like that, it doesn't just involve like the muscles and organs that are involved in that process. Every muscle of my body was part of that exercise. I mean, like, why is my feet hurting? Why are my toes hurting? It was all part of that just violent.
Yeah, it's got to get it out.
Getting sick. And then you feel like an elation, like you feel so much better. Okay, so that's not that interesting. People don't want to hear about that.
No.
But then my sink is now clogged. My sink is clogged. And I don't know what to do. So, you know, I'm thinking that maybe if I put water in it, just turn the water on.
That's what you would do at home, right? Like,
no, I would not. That might dilute it a little bit and maybe it would go down, but it didn't. It just filled up to the top and it started going out the little hole.
Oh.
You know the hole, the, like the outflow hole?
Right, the emergency, like you left the water on hole.
And so I turn it off and it doesn't go down any further. It's stuck there.
And we're on a rolling ship. Like we're it's rolling like it's pitching like 30 degrees every 5 to 10 seconds.
So
left and right.
You can guess what happens next, right? The ship pitches and the contents in the sink go over the edge and just splatter down on the floor. Just starts gushing over the floor. The floor is now flooded with this disgusting cocktail of some soap, some vomit, and water. And now I'm in a panic. Now what am I going to do? So I run out and I look for housekeeping. I find someone from housekeeping and she comes in and she looks and she goes, oh no, oh no. This is apparently, you know, above her pay grade to be able to handle something like this. So she runs and they've come back with maintenance guys. And the maintenance guys are dressed in yellow slickers, like you would see like the Gordon's fishermen wear, with helmets and face shields, like a hazmat team.
Right, like you have Ebola.
Right. And their job is to fix a sink and clean everything up. Now, to complicate matters is, if you also know, because you're on the same floor as me, is that if you're walking from the fourth deck in the fifth deck downstairs to go to our deck where the dining rooms are, if you come down the stairway and you turn that corner, you're facing my room.
Right.
That's the first thing you see when you come around the corner after coming down the stairs.
And it just happened to be around dinner time.
It was right before dinner time. And so Heidi's on the PA, and she's saying, it's dinner time, go down to dinner. And the door's wide open, and these three guys in their hazmat suits are standing in my room with the door open. And I'm yelling at them, close the damn door.
Oh, I heard there was some expletives.
It was...
Because, you know, you have to protect your reputation.
Well, it's not my reputation. I want to protect their appetites. They're queuing up to go into the dining room to have dinner. So they finally get it all cleaned up and everything is fine. But that was my first time getting sick in a long time. That was 20-foot swells
that
we're going through. And I think Russ said 90-mile-an-hour winds that they were experiencing on the Cape.
Yeah. That's...
And it was nuts.
We're still going into it right now.
Still going into it. And we're holding on.
You're not going to get sick right now.
I have the mic in one hand, and I've got my hand firmly on the side of the bunk on the other.
Right.
We're in Matt's cabin, by the way.
Right. That's convenient. My sink is pristine.
Matt didn't want to do this in my room for some reason.
All right. Well, where do we even take it from there?
I do want to talk about the avalanche.
Oh, yes.
You want to talk about the avalanche?
Yes.
How you survived the avalanche?
Oh, so I live in Colorado. And in Colorado, and avalanches are no joke. Like if you hear or see an avalanche, that probably means you're in great peril. I have a healthy respect for avalanches where I live. And so we did this landing at this, I guess it was Brown Bluff, right?
Yeah, it was Brown Bluff.
And there was a lot of snow stuck to the side of this huge mountainside, And right below that huge mountainside is where we landed with all of our clients. And we were photographing ice and icebergs and penguins coming and going from the beach right below this huge mountainside full of snow. And I'm photographing this ice with my telephoto lens, just having a good old time. And I hear that sound, the... And you just, oh, like, oh no, that means we're all dead. And I look up, and the entire mountainside is coming down.
Right at us.
Right at me. And I'm like literally right in the path of the avalanche. The in between me and the avalanche was probably 20 feet of beach and a little bit of a rock ledge, and then a big colony of penguins, and then that's the end of the avalanche path. Was right where I was standing.
It was close.
It was very close. And my only instinct was to run. So I look up. Not like, oh, let's save people. Let's like take photographs or video. Like, you know, and I have two cameras on me. No, I'm not going to stop and take video. I'm going to save my life.
Matt is running full speed to the water.
To the ocean. Like, I don't know what good that was going to do, but that was the only thing I could think of was just, and I literally was like, I screamed as loud as I could, and I just started running, and I was like, everyone run. And then I'm starting to run, and I look back, and all of our clients are just standing there like nothing is happening, and I'm the only one running. And I'm like, you guys are all going to die. Fortunately for all of us, the avalanche stopped its path well before hitting the beach where we were standing, but it could have been an incredible disaster.
Could have been. I mean, if there was another shelf, yes, had come down with it,
yes,
it probably would have reached the beach. No joke.
So, I don't know. My instincts kicked in, and I ran. And I was the only person who seemed to think it was a problem.
I took pictures of it as it was coming down.
Well, one of our clients got an awesome video of it.
Yeah.
So, he sent it to me over AirDrop. But, yeah, no.
So, this is fun. I mean, what do we call this? We're like, is this a simulcast?
Yeah, simulcast.
Is it a... cross promotion? What is the proper word for it?
Yeah, because we're gonna release this on both of our podcasts at the exact same time.
Yeah.
And you're going to get like 20,000 downloads and I'll get 100.
No, I don't think so. So you're not interviewing me and I'm interviewing you. We're just having talking.
I mean, we have topics written down that we may or may not ever talk about. No, we will.
No, so what was your highlight of the trip?
Oh, man.
You were here, last year was your first time.
Right.
This is my seventh. And the first time, I know you said it was a huge surprise, the landscapes.
Right.
It was not what you imagined.
Right.
And that's based on what I learned today during your presentation, is that your MO is not to look at images of places that you travel to.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, purposely.
You want to leave your, just kind of wide open and...
Just react.
And kind of react. So, yeah. You were surprised by the landscapes, how majestic and big and immense they are.
Last year. Yeah.
So how has your impressions of Antarctica changed?
Well, you know, it wasn't quite as impressive as last year just because it wasn't as fresh.
Diminishing marginal.
Yeah, you know, diminishing returns or whatever. Yeah. But I will say my favorite moment of the trip was... We had just done that ice walk with that emperor penguin and photographed that spin drift with the chinstrap penguin. And then everyone was exhausted because that morning we had gotten up at like, what was it, like 3 a.m. to photograph an emperor off of an iceberg?
Our first emperor.
Yeah. So everyone had been up for like 20 hours or something and everyone was like, I'm going to bed. But I was just super wired and jazzed. So I stayed up. And I stayed up on the top of the boat at the very top level above the bridge outside. And I was like, this sunset is going to go off. I could just tell, you know, you have that instinct that tells you like, this is happening. And I got to photograph one of the most amazing sunsets I've ever seen. And when you're in Antarctica, you're so low in the latitude that the sunset lasts forever. I mean, it took probably 45 minutes for the sun to finish setting. And the light was just ridiculous. And we're on the boat moving through the ocean. But between us and the setting sun was a series of ice shelves and glaciers and icebergs and penguins floating by. And I was photographing All of it.
And you were by yourself.
By myself. There was nobody else out there with me.
I was in bed.
And I was photographing the setting sun at like 600 millimeters. I can't even describe what was happening, but there was wind. So it was picking up snow on the ice shelf, blowing it around, and then it was filtering through that warm light. And it, just ridiculous scenes.
Was that the night of the full moon?
It was the same night of the full moon. Damn, so I came in to warm my hands up. And I came back out to see how the sunset was going. I mean, it was one of the, it kept going and going and going. And I'm like, oh, I want it to, I want the really good light to be behind that iceberg that's going to be in like 5 minutes. So I went to the other side of the boat to see how things were shaping up. And I was surprised to see the full moon rising right above the top of an incoming iceberg. And so I'm like, well, I'm going to photograph that too.
And you didn't think to come over to cabin 300 and knock on the door?
I knew you were really tired. I know. I felt a little selfish.
It's okay.
But I was like, you know what? If you want to experience it, you got to stay up, baby. You got to sacrifice.
Snooze, you lose.
Of course, I paid for it because I got like a really bad cold that next day.
Yeah.
And it knocked me out for almost 24 hours. So I paid the price.
That was my highlight the same night, but it was on the ice shelf. I mean, think about it. We're on a floating piece of ice.
Right.
In the middle of the Weddell Sea.
Right.
Which is much more remote than
there's nobody.
The west side of the peninsula. Photographing an emperor penguin in this beautiful golden light. Beautiful golden light. Perfect light.
That.
Yeah, we did that. And over us was this huge, like, sweeping cloud that was already beginning to get light on it. You could tell that it was going to be good.
Yeah. And then you and I were waiting, like, for everyone to kind of come back onto the ship. And we're just standing there, kind of just directing traffic. And these two Adelie penguins get up out of the water, and they just start running right towards us. And we're like, okay, we'll photograph you guys too.
That was a highlight, but I missed all the fireworks afterwards. But I'm still fine with that. I'm cool.
No, it was a very, very, very memorable day, for sure.
I'm with you.
Yeah.
We agree.
And it's such a dynamic place. I mean, you know, the sun is only beyond the horizon for like 30 minutes or something, an hour maybe.
It's just dips below for like an hour or so.
Yeah, so, you know, you have really awesome light for a long time.
Yeah. I hate that I missed the moon, though, because we had it all figured out the next day. It was going to be a full moon, but I don't think we ever really agreed whether it was going to come above the horizon or not. I think it might have a little bit, but I think it was too cloudy, so it happened.
Right. Yeah, and we didn't have nearly as good weather this trip as last year, but we did have some nice days that were great for photographing.
It was wild. It was
especially
an adventure.
Especially in, what was that bay with all the reflections where we did the Zodiac tours? That was pretty special.
I don't remember.
It doesn't matter.
It's all blur now.
That was pretty amazing.
I mean, we're on day 20 now.
Yeah, so actually, this is something I wanted to ask you about.
Yeah.
21 days of photography, give or take. I mean, it's probably more like 17 days or something like that if you take all the travel days into account. But do you find it difficult to stay creative and motivated to take photographs when you're out for this long of a period of time?
I do find it hard.
Yeah.
I think there is a school of thought that you can actually be more creative when you're tired, particularly like sleep deprived, because some of your higher order brain functions start shutting down, like when you sleep.
Yeah.
And then that right brain part is like where the spark of creativity happens, gets the upper hand.
Right.
And so I've noticed that if I'm sleep deprived and I do some writing, I can be more creative that way. Mm. Then later when the next morning when left brain takes over, it's got to fix all the mistakes. But I think you can be more creative when you're tired. But when you're physically tired, just because of the long hours and day after day after day,
right?
I do find it to be difficult, and I've experienced that a few times too. But I know you just did a trail, Colorado Trail.
Yeah.
And it was how many miles?
About 500.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
500 miles?
500 miles.
But you did just, what, a few months ago?
Yeah, 35 days.
You did 500 miles.
Yeah, and I climbed 30 mountains on the way.
Wait a minute. You did 500 miles.
Yeah. Which, if you think about like the Appalachian Trail or the PCT or the Continental Divide Trail, it's not that big of a deal, but yeah, it's a lot.
And you brought your camera.
Yep, brought my camera.
So how did you
two
feel?
Two lenses,
after
a tripod.
Hiking what 20 miles a day, and you're at a place and there's a sunset going on. Do you feel inspired or energized enough to get your camera out and get your tripod and think about creating a composition?
Absolutely.
How do you do it?
I was excited for that.
Other than being a sea pirate.
I think that's different though because
Colorado pirate.
Right, we can explain that later, but for me that was different because you're pretty much spending the whole day focused on the basics, like survival, like food, water, shelter. So you don't really have a lot of time for creativity when you're doing a hike like that. So when you actually, you know, get to a destination, you got your tent set up, it's kind of freeing to be able to have that something to look forward to when you get to camp, to make a photograph or to photograph a nice sunset or photograph the Milky Way over a nice calm lake with the meteor shower. I did experience that as well on the hike, which was pretty cool. But yeah, I didn't find it that hard to stay creative for that just because you're hiking. I mean, I averaged like 18 miles a day of hiking. So, you know, you're spending so much time with physical exertion that you're not really tapping into that creative side a ton. I mean, I did take some photos along the way, you know, as I was hiking, but most of the time you're just focused on, okay, I need to get to that spot so that I can be in position to get to that spot. So you don't really think about it.
So maybe it's not, you're too tired to be creative. In the case of that night where I missed the sunset, I was just tired, period. Yeah. And I didn't have the energy to, like, I'm going to stay up another couple hours and go out and do photography.
Right.
So it wasn't a matter of, if I did, I probably would have been creative or could have been creative.
I think so.
So it had really nothing to do with exhaustion or being tired and not being creative. It's just too tired to stay up and wait for something that may or may not happen.
Right.
And sometimes it's a good bet, and sometimes it's a bad bet. In that case, it was a bad one.
Yeah, well, and I don't know. This would be an interesting side topic too, because I feel like when you're in such a novel location like Antarctica, and every day is just, it's constantly changing. It's a very dynamic situation. The landscape is constantly changing. You're on a moving ship, so you just spend time out there. If you don't like the landscape now, just wait 10 minutes and it's going to be totally different. So I find it's not that hard for me to be a little bit creative when everything is changing so quickly, because I can just rely on intuition and just respond to the landscapes that are, you know, literally right in front of you at any given moment. So I'm not sure that it requires a ton of creativity to create okay photographs down here. I mean, maybe I'm just being a little cocky. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that if it were day one, I would have stayed up. If that was day one, and we did get up at 2:30 to photograph the first emperor penguin, because that was our quest. You know, we missed South Georgia. We're going into Weddell Sea. We're going to try to find emperor penguins. We were told our odds were about 20% that this happen.
And I was like, oh, really? Only 20%?
Only 20%. And so then at 2:30, when one was spotted right in front of us on an iceberg, you know, everybody got up and we're out shooting for a couple hours.
3 in the morning or whatever?
Yeah. So it was a long day. And by the time we finished up, it was, what, 10, 10:30?
Yeah, it was late.
And so I was ready for bed. But if that were day one, it was my first day, and I could see the light in how things are setting up, I probably would have stayed up.
Yeah,
some tiredness did factor into the equation.
Right. It's funny, I just laughed because you hear things banging around on the ship, like people, objects. Yeah, things are flying around on this ship right now.
And at that point, one of us may go flying because it is really rocking pretty hard right now.
It is. It's kind of fun, though. I like it. That's why I'm a Colorado pirate, though, because I don't even take medications. I just roll with it.
You are like, you're a rock. You're a rock. I like I said, I got sick, and I felt just awful for a good part of it. And most people were.
Yeah.
But you didn't medicate, and you were fresh and ready to go.
Yeah.
Every time I saw you, I stick my head out, and we go upstairs, and I try to find a coffee or something, and you're just kind of bouncing around with your camera out on the deck.
Yeah, you got to take advantage. I mean, how often are you actually going to be able to come down and do this?
But that's nothing you can control. You can't control whether you're seasick or not either.
That's true.
I did this last year, the whole circuit from Falkland, South Georgia, Antarctica.
And you didn't get sick.
Never even got sick.
Maybe I just haven't gotten unlucky yet. I don't know.
Maybe you are cocky and you are like a Colorado pirate.
Maybe so. So one thing I wanted to ask you about, Richard. So you have been doing a lot of workshops for over a decade now, right?
Yeah, actually more than that.
Yeah.
But
you're still able to come home with a few images here and there that you like, that you're proud of. How hard is it for you to capture photographs that you find personally meaningful on these trips where we're expected to provide instruction and we have to constantly be on the ball to help guide people through the process, but also through using their camera? You know, like how hard is it for you to actually make images while you're on these trips?
It's hard. You know how hard it is, because your first, on a trip like this or any kind of workshop, your first priority is the clients that you're guiding.
Right.
So you're trying to point them in the right direction of what, you know, what's interesting, where an image might be.
Right.
You might even set it up, the composition for them. You're trying to tell them settings.
Right.
And you're making sure everybody's happy and everybody's taken care of before you even get your camera out to start shooting. Okay. So you're going to miss opportunities when it happens, particularly with wildlife, which a landscape is static and you can get everybody set up and you can set up and shoot with them.
Right.
But with wildlife and things are changing quickly, like you're on a boat and the perspectives between icebergs and mountains are changing by the second.
Right.
You're missing shots and they're getting them, but that's the whole point of being here.
For sure.
So it is much more difficult. So it's not surprising that I can speak for you too here, that your best work is done when you're out on your own.
100%.
No distractions, not worrying about somebody falling in the water.
That didn't happen on this trip, by the way.
By a leopard seal. And none of that happened. So, you know, first of all, there's no distractions, no mental distractions. And then your first priority is capturing images, which is not the case like this.
Right.
So if you can snag an image here and there,
right,
I'm happy.
Right.
I'm more than happy. If I can come home with a dozen, you know, A images or A plus images, I'm happy. But that's a secondary objective.
For sure. I will say, though, on this trip, I feel like we were particularly lucky in that almost every single photographer that was on this trip was exceptionally competent.
Very good.
Yeah, very good photographers. In fact, they were making images that were way better than anything I would ever do. So, you know, which is not a very high bar, but, you know.
You went from cocky to Mr. Humble in about, what, 5 minutes?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, some of the stuff people were sharing with us is just exceptional.
They were good. So very few people needed a lot of help.
Yeah.
And, you know, we would go around and say, does anybody need any help? Everybody good?
And they're like, get out of my way.
And they're like, just leave me alone. I'm photographing here.
Exactly. Yeah.
Should we give Munch Workshops a plug at some point?
Sure.
I mean, they may be listening.
They might be.
Andy and Mark and David, they might be listening to this, and they will be wondering, why, talking about this workshop, and then not mention Munch Workshops yet, why haven't you done it, guys?
Right. Well, what do you have coming up? What's your next one?
Well, I think, first of all, we should say, this is a Munch Workshop trip.
It is.
And we're both pros for Munch, so that should make the bosses happy.
Right. Maybe.
Okay. And I do have Thailand coming up next month, so I'm kind of looking forward to that.
Yeah, that'll be awesome.
So, what was your question? Did you have a question?
Yeah, it was like, how hard is it to come home with good images of your own?
Hard.
Yeah.
Hard.
It's really
difficult. Happy. I may have, 10 to 12 images that I'm proud of, and I'm happy with that.
Yeah, me too.
But I didn't stay out till 2 in the morning when everybody's sleeping.
Well,
either.
That was partially why I did that.
That's a good strategy.
Because I noticed, like, I had mentioned to everyone I ran into, like, I think the sunset's going to be really good tonight. You should stay up. And everyone I talked to was like, no way, I'm going to bed. I'm like, okay, I guess it's just going to be me. And yeah, I didn't have to worry about instructing anyone because everyone was asleep.
That moonshot you got was
good.
Spectacular.
It was nice.
Yeah.
I liked it.
It's like between two icebergs and there's about a third of a moon, maybe half of a moon, just big orange moon on the horizon, just right between these two icebergs. It's
not bad.
It's something to be proud of.
Yeah, lucky.
Mateo, be proud. Be proud. You did good. I'm proud for you.
Yeah, no, it was good. I mean, like I said, I had no idea it was even coming. And I just looked over to the other side of the ship and I was like, that's the moon. And I just got really excited because I was like, there's going to be a ton of possibilities to photograph a full moon over some icebergs.
I'm happy for you, Matt. I really am.
I think you're salty.
I'm really happy for you.
Well, one of the things I admire you for is you have a tremendous amount of business acumen. Like you're always on the prowl for the next really good business relationship, and you have found a way to pull that off with a lot of your, you know, you've got sponsors for your podcast. You've got, you know, Lexar basically gives you $25 every time someone said that. I just got you $25 by saying Lexar.
Thank you. Thank you. Cha-ching.
Right?
Right.
Yeah. So, like, what's your strategy behind that? Like, how have you been able to pull that off?
I think my strategy is that I don't have a strategy. First of all, any brands that I work with, with the exception of one, I won't mention it, but every single one I used extensively before that. So it wasn't like I was pitching products that I didn't use or just right. For the sake of pitching them. There were products I used anyway. And, you know, the social media presence I have doesn't hurt.
Sure.
So when it comes time to like approaching a company that I use and say, hey, how would you like to collaborate? We can help each other out mutually. It helps to have that behind you, that number, mm-hmm. that's the follower number. So I don't know if it's anything I'm doing special. It's just having that number helps, right? Yeah, and then just asking. And I hope that every, you know, brand that I work with, it finds it mutually beneficial,
right?
That I'm benefiting in some way and they're benefiting some way, and that's how any good relationship should be.
Absolutely.
So I have no way to, you know, quantify that. I'm sure they do if they're sticking with me and they're still, you know, sponsoring me in different ways. I'm assuming on their part that they have a way to quantify it and it makes sense financially. But I wouldn't ever promote or put my name on something that I didn't use or I didn't believe in.
Right. No, I'm the same way. I, even though I don't have a million Twitter followers like you do, I do get asked from time to time to, you know, promote stuff that, you know, maybe it's like a certain backpack or, and I'm just like, no, I don't want to use that. I'm not going to promote that. No, thank you.
Yeah.
You know?
So you do have to learn how to say no, because that, you know, that is, having a million followers does get noticed, and I get a lot of proposals over the email, and most don't even see the light of day. I just don't even respond. Might as well go down this road, but we were just joking tonight about OnlyFans. Oh.
Okay.
And it was a joke on Twitter. So people would, you know, I would post images, and some people would say, why don't we ever get to see you, you know, behind the camera, you know, some behind the scenes shots. And I would jokingly say, well, that's my OnlyFans. I put those on my OnlyFans page. So this is a running joke for a while. And, you know, some people don't see all the jokes. So I have to continue that, you know, that same joke over and over again. Well, at some point, I guess OnlyFans noticed it and they reached out and said, hey, we'll give you a free account. We'll do this for you. We'll do that for you. And I screenshotted it and I posted it on Twitter because it was just a running gag. But I mean, have a look at me. It's just like some things people are going to want to see this and pay for it. I don't think so.
One thing I have learned is there is a niche for everything, including huggable 55-year-old men with gray beards.
I'm not going down that road. Sorry, Matt. Sorry. I'm going to have to cut this short. What's next on your list? I'm uncomfortable talking about this.
What's on your list?
But yeah, OnlyFans was something that was a hard no, but I did use it to at least some comedic effect.
Absolutely. All right. So kind of go along those same lines of business success in photography. I'm sure you found this to be the case as well, that the most successful photographers might not necessarily be the best photographers on planet Earth.
Right.
But they've found a way to incorporate lots of other skill sets into their messaging or their branding. For example, maybe they're a good writer, or they're good at marketing, or they're good at coming up with business relationships, whatever it is.
Yeah.
What are some of the ancillary skill sets that you've had to leverage in your career?
I mean, I've always said this, and this is going back, I said this 20 years ago when I first started out as a pro. And at that time, there were a lot of publications that you could write for, and you could submit, you know, text image packages to get published and get paid. That's not the case anymore, but it's true then and it's true now, and that is writing. And writing's a skill that I wished I spent more time studying when I was younger, like in college or even high school, just paying attention and understanding how important that could be, probably in most professions, being a good writer.
Right.
But specifically this profession, where you're constantly creating content, whether it be blogs or you're doing magazine articles or books or creating tweets or whatever it may be, writing is such a valuable skill to have. And I managed to get it done, but it takes me 10 times longer than someone who really was trained and knows how to write.
Mm-hmm.
I had to work on some projects with real writers, and we would go out and I would see how fast they were able to create, you know, edited, beautifully written content in a fraction of the time it would have taken me.
Right.
And I wish I had that skill.
Right.
I don't.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think writing is a huge skill to have in the photography space. I'm fortunate that I enjoy writing, and I leverage it as often as I can.
I don't enjoy it.
Yeah.
If I was better at it, I think I would be. I would like it, but it's a chore.
Gotcha.
I really hate it.
Well, so what, I mean, not to brag for you on yourself, but like, what are some skill sets that you do enjoy, that you are good at, that you've had to tap into over the years to find success?
You tell me. What do you do that's so good? What made you, Matteo?
I thought you were gonna have me talk about you.
No. This is we're talking about each other. So I already told you what I suck at, and that's writing. That I wish I was better at.
Okay, well, for sure, writing. I've always been really good at computers and like having technical skills with computers. You know, like I can pretty much figure out most software. If you give me enough time, I'll just kind of figure it out. Like I've taken very little, any classroom instruction on Lightroom or Photoshop. I just kind of just get in there and screw around until I figure it out. So I'd say having a curiosity for technology and figuring out how it works, that's really been helpful for me. Like building websites and stuff, I just figured out. Like I've never been trained. I just dive in and try to do it. I think one that goes super underappreciated that I feel like I leverage a lot of times is just people skills. Being able to...
You are good, really good with that.
Oh, thank you. But, you know, be able to sit down at a table with someone you've never met before and have a good conversation with them, you know, like, because that's what we do in our work. You know, we have to get to know a lot of interesting, diverse people and give them a good experience and be good listeners and understand what their problems are. I mean, that's essentially what our jobs are, right? We have to dig out, what problems are you experiencing? And then how can I help you solve those problems, right? Like, that's essentially our job.
You're super good at that.
That's essentially our job,
yeah,
as professional photographers in the teaching space.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Because we don't always know what...
You're also really patient. You're a really patient person. I think you are much more patient than I am. Like when the really ridiculous, dumb questions are coming in.
We don't get those.
And every fiber of my body wants to come back with some, you know, really smart aleck comment or response. I just hold back. But you are so patient. You listen to them very compassionately and empathetically and walk them through the problem, even if it's just something that we just said 5 minutes ago.
Well, that never happens.
We could get ourselves in trouble here.
Oh. No, I mean...
No, you are really, really good at that.
Well, thank you. And that's essentially what this job entails. I mean, yes, you have to know how to use a camera, okay? You have to understand shutter speed, aperture, ISO. You have to understand how to focus modes work. Hopefully, you can understand more than one camera system. That's a big challenge of our job, actually, is the constant change in technology. We're always learning about, okay, this camera does what now? And how do you turn that on? Like, that's a huge part of our job that...
I'm going to ask you a question.
Yeah.
So, what resource do you use to keep up with the new cameras coming in and all their features? Where do you learn this? How do you keep up with it? Because it's something we both have to do. I'm just curious what you use.
So a lot of people would probably jump to YouTube for that. But I, for some reason, I just don't like video content. For me, like, it's too clickbaity and it's often full of, I don't know, like, it's just not genuine. So I actually spend a lot of time in a Discord channel with a lot of other landscape photographers at various levels. And a lot of people are asking questions constantly in there about new gear that's coming out, or they're excited about new gear that's coming out. And I get to have conversations in there with a lot of my favorite photographers about stuff like the latest camera or what a new lens can do, or a different technique we learned about. So for me, it's social media channels where I'm engaged in having conversations with people that I trust.
It's great.
That's my go-to. Yeah.
I don't have that community.
You could join.
I had.
You'd be great. People would love you there. We talk about you all the time.
I'm sure. No, I that's actually a challenge for me because I'm not a technical guy. I don't really like that part of the photography.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's something that I have to force myself to kind of keep up with. Oh, Sony's got a new camera coming out. Now I have to read the specs, right, so I know somewhat what it does.
16 stops of dynamic range, and it's 22.7% better than the Canon Mark IV. No,
and I really don't care.
That's a joke.
I don't care. But there are new features. It's the new features that
right.
you have on.
Right, like, right,
it
right.
It can do what now? I mean, right. some of what the cameras could do now is just kind of incredible.
Right.
And then learning a little bit about where to find it, how it works.
Right.
So that when someone in the field has that camera and they're asking how, you know, how does this camera do, you know, focus stacking, you know,
right.
automatic focus, to have a general idea how that works. If they
right.
have the manual that we can work it through together. But, you know, you don't want to, you want to appear like you're, that you know what you're talking about a little bit, right? But
for
it's
sure.
hard to keep up with it. It changes so fast.
It does. And what I've found is most people are okay with you saying, you know, I don't know, but let's figure it out together, right?
That's my default answer.
Yeah.
Unless I happen to know.
Yeah. I have no idea where that setting is in your camera, but let's find it.
That's
most
the
people
best
are good
approach.
With that.
Yeah, but I still want to know, you know, just some of the latest, just general features that each camera, a new lens comes out.
For sure.
And you have to stay on top of it. And that's really the most boring part of of photography for me.
Right.
And I was just curious where you learned it, because you seem to know more about it than me.
Yeah, I just, I have lots of good friends that shoot different systems than I do. And we were always talking about, oh, your camera does what? I wish my camera did that right. kind of thing. So, yeah. So... I'm excited that this is going to go on your podcast and my podcast, because I do listen to your show and I love your podcast. I feel like I've never really heard you talk about yourself as much as I'd like you to on your show, which is fine, but this, so I'm going to pull you out of your shell a little bit.
Uh-oh.
What originally drew you to love photography? Like, what was it about photography for you that really got you excited and wanting to pursue it for the rest of your life as a career?
It was relatively late in life.
Yeah.
And I think I went through my 20s were pretty wild. I was single through my 20s, and my priorities were with this, you know, corporate life that I was living and all the other things that went with that, and being 20 and single. And then somewhere around 30 or so, I kind of grew up in a way, and I reconnected with a love that I had as a child, which was nature.
Yeah.
And that's what I loved when I was a kid. So I reconnected, and then I started going places on backpacking trips and mountain biking and fly fishing and just travel. And like most people, took a camera to kind of show your family and friends what you're doing, what you're seeing.
Right, right.
And, you know, these were point-and-shoot film cameras, and obviously what the end result was nothing like what you experienced. And so I'm just curious, why... That's the camera's job, right? Is to, you point it at something, it's supposed to look like what you saw, and it didn't. So I am naturally curious. So I'm curious, wonder why that is. And I bought better equipment, bought a better camera, and that didn't really help much. And then just began to explore about how the human visual system works and how the camera and film works and how different they are and how it was a miracle that any picture looked like what you saw. And, before I knew it, I was going out not for all those activities I mentioned earlier. I was going out for take pictures.
Right.
Because that was my goal, is right. to improve on what I did last time. And I started writing for these magazines and sending in, you know, my photos, and I liked them. And, you know, by my standards today, they're really pretty crappy, but people liked them. And so
right.
they bought them. And I saw, well, this is something that I really, really enjoy. And I think it's part of human nature to want to express to other people the things that you love that are meaningful to you.
Yeah.
And being in nature and seeing these places were what was meaningful to me at that time. And I'm not a writer, so I couldn't write about those things to share it. I could write songs or poetry about it. That would be ridiculous. or paint. I couldn't do that. I couldn't do any kind of art. But photography was one outlet that I felt natural to me.
Yeah.
Particularly after doing some study and learning on my own, that I could share my experiences and share those places that were meaningful to me with other people. And this was the most natural way.
Yeah.
And that's really where it started, you know? And then I was at a point in my career where, you know, I was tired of what I was doing. It was a great job, but it wasn't what I wanted to do the rest of my life. And
yeah.
I was relatively young. I was in my 30s. And I said, if I don't make a go at this, I'll probably regret it to the rest of my life.
Right.
I could always, you know, get a conventional job 2 years. I'll give myself 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
If it doesn't work out, I could always go back to another conventional career again.
Right.
But if I never gave myself a chance, then I would never forgive myself. And I was at that age where if I waited any longer, it was going to be really hard to do.
That
makes
sense.
And that was 20 years ago. It was 2003.
Ah, you're on your 20-year anniversary.
20-year anniversary. Yeah. So that's awesome. The short story.
Yeah.
There's a lot of ups and downs and
right.
crazy twists and turns along the way.
But right.
that's the condensed version.
Right. Yeah.
How about yourself?
You know, actually very similar to that. I started out in photography as a means to photograph my hiking journeys. In 2007, I decided I wanted to climb the highest 100 mountains in Colorado. And the lowest of that highest 100, I think, is like 13,870 feet or something like that. So they're all pretty high. And I just wanted to take pictures along the way so that I could, you know, share them with friends and family and have just a documented record of what I had accomplished. And part of that for me was that my dad had also set that goal for himself when he was younger. He had tried to climb the highest 100 mountains, and unfortunately, he stopped climbing because of me. I got really good at baseball, and he would, you know, he was a good dad, and instead of going mountain climbing, he would go to all my baseball games every summer. So, like, instead of, you know, finishing his goal of climbing the highest 100 mountains in Colorado, he was a good parent. So, I had this goal of wanting to do that, partially because it was his goal, but then also with the camera side of things, he didn't take hardly any pictures along that journey. And so, like, every time I was going to go on a new trip, I'd ask him, like, so what is this mountain like? You know, what do I have to look out for on this one? And he would have to describe it for me. Like, there was no pictures or there was no text. So I decided I wanted not only to take pictures, but I wanted to do a website, and I would do a blog post about every like a trip report for every mountain I would climb. And so I created a website. I wanted to teach myself how to create a website. So I created a website in Joomla, which is a terrible decision, by the way. In retrospect, I should have used WordPress, but that's... And I just started taking pictures of my journey. And about 2 years into that, I started realizing that I was getting myself into some pretty amazing places in some amazing light. And the camera that I had and the skills that I had as a photographer were not doing them justice. So I decided to buy myself a actual SLR. I got a Nikon D7000. And I went to the library and I checked out every single book in the library on photography that I could find. I'm like, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it right. That's just the way I'm wired. I'm like, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it hardcore. And then I just started practicing with my camera as much as I could. I took it everywhere with me for like the first year or two. And then slowly the photography kind of overtook the mountain climbing in terms of what I was really interested in. Like the mountain climbing.
Sounds just like my journey.
Yeah, the mountain climbing was just a means for getting to good spots for photographs. So that's kind of how I got into it. And now I still do mountain climbing, but it's not nearly as much as the focus. The focus is to get photographs that are awesome. So, yeah.
So this is something we talked about earlier today, just kind of sitting around the lounge on the ship, that I don't carry my camera everywhere I go.
Right.
And people assume that because we're photographers, and I've heard other people say this, always take my camera with me everywhere I go because you never know. Maybe you see something, and you and I are both like, no, we don't.
Absolutely not.
No. So why don't you?
Well, part of that, I think it's really easy to let those situations affect you psychologically. You know, you're driving down the highway and you see an amazing sunset or something and you're like, oh, I wish I was taking a picture of that. And so for me, not having my camera with me, it's like it's giving myself permission to just experience those moments and not have to photograph every single awesome sunset or sunrise that I see, right? And let's face it, how many times have you actually randomly brought your camera with you somewhere and actually used it to create a fantastic photograph? Almost never.
Never.
Right? Maybe once or twice, right? But almost never. And so I don't think it's a bad technique if you're starting out because, you know, you're becoming more familiar with your camera settings and learning how to, you know, quickly change your aperture, whatever. But, you know, once you've got that stuff dialed in, I don't think it makes a whole lot of sense to take a camera everywhere you go, mostly because you have to start thinking about the people around you. Like my wife was like, come on, man, do you really need to sit here another 5 minutes to photograph this? You know, it's starting to ruin family vacations. So when we go on trips, you know, that aren't specific for photography, which we don't do together anyway, I don't even bring my camera, you know. Or I maybe bring it, but like I'll get up early before everyone else, go take some pictures, and then I'll put the camera away for the rest of the day. To me, it's like it's about being present with yourself, it's about being present with nature, it's about being present with your family and your friends, and a lot of times the camera can get in the way of that.
Plus, most of the time the camera, where you are doing your daily life, it's not going to be a good picture anyway. I remember walking out of Walmart with a friend. We had to pick up some supplies. And this great sunset.
Oh, of course it's the Walmart parking lot.
Yeah, it's the Walmart parking lot.
Of course.
And they're like, oh, I bet you wish you had your camera now. I'm like, yeah, that's going to be great. The sunset from the Walmart parking lot. No, just enjoy it. You know, it's a gift you got. This great sunset. Let's just get out of here and just watch it and appreciate it and enjoy it. I don't have to take a picture of it. I just have to be a certain mindset to go out and do photography, and it's just my daily life. I'm not in that mindset.
Right. Yeah. I'd be interested in talking to you a little bit more about that too, the mindset that goes into making images, because hearing you talk about that over the last couple of days, I get the sense that for you to get into that zone of being able to make personally meaningful images requires a little bit of effort and you have to control your environment a little bit more in terms of being by yourself and, you know, giving yourself more space and time to be present with nature or whatever. And for myself, it's not always necessarily that for me. So I'm curious if you might talk a little bit about that necessity to have those variables in a specific space for you in order to make images.
Yeah, first of all, I have to be alone most of the time, or with some other photographer friends.
Yeah,
Not a situation like this.
Right.
Yeah. And but it helps to be alone, because then I don't have to worry about the other person. You know, if someone else is with you, you have to worry about, well, do they like this spot? Are they ready to leave or not? Or are they having a good time? Are they cold? Or, you know, all those things. When you're by yourself, you don't have to worry about any of that.
Right.
You just, it's just you. It's selfish, but that's the way you have to work. And now I'm going to do photography, and now I'm in that mindset. And my mindset is that I want to be as quiet as far as my mind, and you say it's almost like a meditative state, but just being very receptive to something speaking to me.
Right.
And we were laughing about that earlier about, you know, what did you call it? Woo-woo?
Yeah.
Woo-woo talk.
Yeah.
About something speaking to me, very new age-y.
Right.
But that's what it is.
You have to get out your crystals.
And if you think about why do you, if you're on a hike and you have your camera and your tripod and you stop to take a picture, somewhere, something made you stop.
Right.
And something spoke to you, whether you want to think that's funny or not, that's just the way it is. Something
For sure.
does speak to you. And I want to be as quiet as possible so I could hear that when that happens. And when that happens, then I don't just whip out the camera and start shooting whatever that is. I ask questions. You know, why is this? What is this? It's drawing me to this
right.
scene or this object or this subject. And, you know, if I can't answer some simple questions as to having a good reason to photograph, I'll just kind of move on. And you know, shooting something or photographing something just because it's interesting is usually not enough for me.
Mm.
I want to have like some sort of emotional trigger there that I'm
gotcha.
Feeling something.
Yeah.
And I want to capture it in such a way that people who weren't there can see my image and feel the same thing.
Right.
That's ultimately what I think is a successful image is. And to really accomplish that, I have to be alone, and I have to be being receptive is, I think, the key word. Is if you're just with buddies and you're sitting around, you're talking and you're walking along the trail, you're not really paying attention, you're not really being receptive, then I'm going to miss a lot of things.
So I have a lot of photography friends. Most of them are introverts. Are you an introvert?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think most of my life I thought I was an extrovert.
Uh-huh.
And then we had that little retreat in Arizona. Remember that?
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
And we talked about that?
Yeah.
And at some point, I think I read that book that they mentioned. The definition was along the lines of, and I think you may have mentioned this, is that if you get your energy
yeah.
from other people, you're an extrovert.
Right.
And if you get your energy from
being alone,
like pulling yourself away from other people and being alone, that's how I re-energize myself, then you're an introvert. And by
right.
that definition, I'm an introvert.
I've kind of found through unscientific research, just observation and getting to know other people, I've found that people who tend to be more introverted, that's an essential component of their creative, tapping into their creative side, being alone. Whereas I find myself, I'm a little bit more extroverted than most nature and landscape photographers. I like to be around people. And what I have found is that oftentimes I make some really interesting images when I'm excited and around other people that I can share that image with, or that I can get excited with them and experience whatever that thing is with somebody else. But I find that I'm a kind of a weirdo in that regards. I don't think a lot of people have that.
That's not me. I think people, and I like people.
Yeah.
It's not that I dislike them, but being around people for too long, I feel like my energy reserves are being depleted.
Right.
And I have to go be alone for a while to re-energize before I can go back out to be with people again.
Right.
And I know people who are the exact opposite. They hate being alone. They have to get around other people, and that's how they derive their energy.
Right.
So I can't relate to that. I'm definitely an introvert.
Yeah, it's funny. You mentioned me doing my 500-mile hike this summer. And people have asked me lots of questions about, were you afraid of bears or mountain lions or like running out of food or, you know, all these things. I'm like, no. The only thing that I was worried about was being lonely. Literally, that was the only thing that I was seriously concerned with in doing a 35-day trip.
But that may not have anything to do with being an introvert or extrovert, because I'm pretty sure I'm an introvert. And I did nothing like what you did, but I did a 26-day canoe trip back in 2007.
Right.
And I remember that all these preparations I made about, you know, had these dams I have to portage around, and I have to camp here and camp there, and all these, where am I going to stop and get food?
Right.
The one thing I didn't prepare for was being lonely. And I'm like, that's not going to happen. You know, I was like, this is happening to me. I'm being lonely. I mean, don't they, this is, I'm me. I'm not going to be lonely. That's not, you know, I didn't have to worry about that. I didn't even think about it, but I was. I started seeking out people, which is really strange for me. So I'd see a boat of people on it, and I'd want to paddle over to where they were just to make contact with somebody.
Right.
Because 20 some days by yourself is a long time.
It is.
And so I noticed that was something, like, I've noticed it real time. It's just happening, like, wow, this is really strange. I didn't even consider that being a factor of what might be affecting me on this trip, and it was.
Yeah.
But that may just be human.
It is, but I'm just, I do feel like there's a connection there between creativity and our relationship with where we get energy from in terms of interaction with other people. This fall, I had a weird schedule change for my normal fall color trips. I normally will leave home, be out for like 10 to 14 days with my friends, and then come home. But this year, because I had a Munch workshop like in the middle of all that, I went out for a couple of days, not with any plan in mind, with any friends. And then I came home and did the workshop and went back out. And I found myself way less motivated to make photographs when it was just me by myself with no plan or anything like that. It was so strange. I was like, because I hadn't experienced that in a long time on a fall color trip. And so it was a real good reminder for me that for me, at least for my fall color trips, what makes them the most exciting is that I get to hang out with my friends. Like, it's a social event. And it just reminded me that, yeah, I make some fun, awesome images, but really what I love about those trips is hanging out with my friends.
So, yeah, we're very different there. I like hanging out with friends, but not when I'm out doing photography. I think I'm more creative by myself. I know I do better images by myself. I'm more productive on my own. And then afterwards, hanging out is great.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah. I think it was more just knowing that I didn't have any friends to hang out with at the end of the day. You know, I would come home to a campsite and it would just be me. Like, that was very depressing.
I'm feeling kind of dizzy right now.
Oh, it is shaken.
I mean, I'm like kind of lightheaded and feeling a little dizzy at the moment. But well, keep it going. Let's not stop.
It is shaken, shaken, shaken. All right. Well, totally shifting gears.
Okay.
One thing that I also know about you that I think a lot of people might not appreciate as much as they should is that you are actually like really, really, really good at composition. In terms of thinking about composition, understanding composition, how to arrange visual elements in a photograph. What are some of the things that you're looking for in composition when you're in the field?
Because this answer is going to disappoint a lot of people. Because I don't really have anything that I'm not actually even thinking about composition in the field. So what I've learned in teaching this, and I do a lot of classes on composition, is that I've, over 20 years, photography's been the major part of my life.
Right.
And maybe even beyond that. And I'm either taking pictures, I'm editing pictures, I'm looking at pictures, other people's images, I'm looking through books, magazines. It's such a big part of my life. In learning composition, I've just really studied it, that all of that has become just a part of the way I see.
Right.
It's just incorporated the way I see every day. If I'm driving, I'm doing composition.
Yeah.
I am. When I'm walking to the mailbox, I'm doing composition. So it's just the way I see. So when I'm in the field, that's one less thing I have to think about. I don't think about it. I'm looking through the viewfinder and either feels right or doesn't feel right.
Right.
I don't ask why. I just, whoa, hold on, buddy.
Hold on.
So I don't even think about it. It's either it feels right or doesn't feel right. And I'll ask later as I'm you know, I'm looking through my images and editing, I might say, oh, look, I did this, I did that. But I'm not even thinking about it at the moment. But there are times when I have like a big theme in my head. For example, like going to a forest.
Yeah.
It's really, we're really rocking right now. we are. Go to a forest. I'm not thinking composition, but I may have a big idea in my head, like, you know, order out of chaos kind of thing. Like, right. That's in the back of my head.
Right, conceptually.
Yeah, like it's a big concept, and I'm just kind of like a mantra as I'm going through, you know, I'm observing, and I'm looking, and I'm feeling around for compositions or scenes. I'm not thinking about composition, but I do have this mantra that maybe, like, I need to find order. I'm trying to find order. Mm. Or maybe some things when I'm doing wildlife where I'm thinking balance. I'm just thinking balance. But I'm not really consciously thinking about composition at the time, and I'm kind of glad I'm not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it can really get in your head.
But I'm looking through the viewfinder, and this feels right, and this doesn't feel right. If it feels right, then I'm going to take the photo. If it doesn't feel right, I just keep hunting, I'm searching, right. I keep trying different angles, getting higher, getting lower. I like the subject, obviously it appeals to me, and I'm finding just the right angle, the right perspective, until it feels right. And when it feels right, then I take the photo. But I don't ask why until later, maybe.
And what I found is what's really fun about being on a moving ship, like, seriously though, I guess this was yesterday when we went to Deception Island and we did that little cruise around the inside of Deception Island.
Right.
We had this beautiful fresh snow on black sand hillsides.
It's amazing.
Just patterns everywhere. But the perspective was constantly shifting just a little bit because you're on a slowly moving boat. And what I found myself doing is like, okay, I see there's a photograph emerging over there, but it's not ready yet because that's in the way, or, you know, like, oh, wouldn't it be nice if those lines were a little bit in a different spot. And so you're right, like it's intuition, and I guess it just kind of comes with experience and photographing a lot of really bad images, you know, like the more bad images you can take and the more images you can digest.
Yeah, and when you're teaching, that answer frustrates people.
It does.
Because it doesn't really help.
It doesn't.
So I try, I make an analogy, and I have several of them, but the one I've been using lately is like a jazz guitarist or jazz you know, saxophone player, that when they're up there with the jazz quartet and they're playing, they're not thinking about musical composition. They're not thinking about where their fingers are on the fretboard or chords or scales or notes. They're not thinking about any of that. They're just going with what feels the music. Where's the music taking them next? And just kind of going with it. But they had to learn all that stuff to get to that point. They had to learn scales and notes and chords and musical compositions so they can get to the point where they forget it. And so when I answer that I don't really think about composition when I'm when I'm doing photography is, but I had to learn all that stuff to get to the point where I have to think about it.
Right.
And that's the key, is that doing photography is the best way to learn it. Looking at photos, other people's photos, and you just learn there's certain patterns and certain way things are put together on the image frame, and that you learn what works and what doesn't work, and it becomes just a part of how you see. And there's no shortcut to get to that point where you can just not have to worry about or even think about it anymore.
Well, and I hate it when people say, like, oh, I can't learn that, or like, it's hard to, I wasn't born with being able to do that.
That's
because
BS.
It's not true. I mean, I think about myself as I have a photography competition called the Natural Landscape Photography Awards, and every year we get about 10 to 15,000 images submitted, and there's four of us that kind of prejudge them to like figure out what's going to go on to the final judging. And there's pretty good agreement amongst the four of us about, you know, what images are good and which ones aren't necessarily as good, not only from a technical perspective, but also composition. And a lot of it is like you said, you look at an image and it either feels good or it doesn't. And sometimes you can't even explain why it feels good or why it doesn't. But I guarantee, if you're listening to this and you feel like you're a person who doesn't know how to do composition or whatever, I'm not good at composition, guarantee you, go pick up a photography book or something and flip through it. And you're going to find images that you're more drawn to than others. And that, to me, is how you become a better photographer. Lean into those images that you find more interesting, and you're going to start to learn about yourself. Like, and you're going to start to gravitate towards those types of compositions in your own work as well. You're not copying somebody else. You're basically, you're gaining pattern recognition about what appeals to you visually.
Yeah. So when people say that, I tell them right off, that's BS.
Yeah.
Is that I just don't have an eye for it. I wasn't born with
right,
that
talent. I don't have a good eye.
Yeah. And I say, well, if I hand you a photography or a portfolio of images from amateurs, and you just look through them, you could tell me which are the good ones and the bad ones without knowing anything about composition, right? And
right.
I said, yes. Then you already have the tools, everything you need.
Exactly.
Right? Then you know the difference. You just have to apply it and refine it and then and practice it. So, no, I think composition is a very left-brained, I think people think it's a right-brained thing, but it's a very left-brained skill that you learn, like any other skill.
100%. Yeah, I totally agree.
Good.
were you gonna like crash into me during the?
Well, I thought maybe we'd have this debate, but we agree on that.
Yeah, we agree.
100%.
Yeah, what I found, Richard, is that there's not a ton of stuff we disagree on.
No, we're pretty cool. Seriously, lightheaded. This is good, though.
All right. Well, I think we've covered a lot of ground, and you know, I think in the interest of not having the rest of the room crash in on us, this is probably a great stopping point.
It was a great conversation.
Yeah.
I love this. We should do this again. We should make this a regular photography free-for-all conversation and just kind of touch base and do one of these just random, you know, let it fly, whatever's on top of your head, just talk about it.
Yeah. It's good. Well, I'm just happy to have a conversation with you. I love hanging out with you on these trips. It's always a lot of fun. So you were our trip leader this trip because of some unforeseen circumstances, but I was really happy that you were our trip leader because I knew I'd get along well with you, and it's just been a really fun trip.
Likewise. Cheers.
Yeah, cheers, man. All right. Peace out.
Peace out.
Well, thank you to Richard for the fun chat and for continuing to inspire me along my own journey. I am so happy to be co-leading trips with you with Munch Workshops, and I can't wait to do another trip with you. Richard is a fantastic educator, and I highly recommend you subscribe to his Substack and his podcast. If you enjoyed our chat, please help me continue to keep the show going by supporting it on Patreon. Thanks to Peter Daskalos, who recently pledged to support the show. To join, just go to patreon.com/fstop and listen. Cheers. That's all for now. Thanks for stopping in, collaborating with us, and listening. See you next week.